you like this episode, please subscribe, share with others, rate and review so we can continue to bring you great programming.
Welcome to Inclusion Catalyst. We invite diversity leaders to the table to deconstruct complex social justice issues and showcase the best inclusion practices in our workplaces and our communities.
What's up, everybody? This is Julian Geiser from Great Art Consulting, and you're listening to the Inclusion Catalyst podcast. The goal of each episode is to give people the perspectives, tools, and resources they need to create the inclusive environments that truly reflect the diversity of our modern workforce. I sit down with various agents of change to discuss the ideas, the opportunities, and the strategies that need to be implemented to effectively bring change. Men, as a group, continue to be an underengaged and underinvested demographic when it comes to advancing equity across gender, race, and other aspects of identity. Today on the show, we're discussing male allyship and exploring some of the common deflections we hear from men that keep them from getting into the game. Joining us, we're excited to welcome back to the show Dave Smith, co-author of the book Good Guys, How Men Can Be Better Allies for Women in the Workplace, and an associate professor at the Johns Hopkins Carey Business School. A former Navy pilot, Dave has led diverse organizations of women and men, culminating in command of a squadron in combat, and flew more than 3,000 hours over 30 years, including combat missions in Iraq and Afghanistan. As a sociologist, he focuses his research in gender, work, and family issues, including allyship, inclusive mentorship, gender bias in performance evaluations, and dual career families. He is the co-author of Athena Rising, How and Why Men Should Mentor Women, and numerous journal articles and book chapters that focus on gender and the workplace. Welcome, Dave. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Julian. Great to be back with you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're glad to have you. And I love reading bios, but I'm always aware as the person that's been on receiving end of a bio sometimes, like how grateful I am when we're kind of through that stuff and we can get to the meat of the conversation. As we get started today, I was hoping that you might share a few aspects of your identity that are most important to you. And the reason I'm asking is that one of the challenges that we've found in our work is that men, and white men in particular, because of the accrual of advantages in a world largely built by people that look like us, you and I are both white guys, that we struggle to talk about aspects of our identity. And I think it misses a really important opportunity for us to share a humanizing aspect of our own story and to consider the importance of personal identity overall. So with that, a little bit of context, Dave, how do you identify?
That's a great question. I'm glad you started with that. And Julia, I'm gonna hit kind of two areas I think are interesting and different in very different ways. And one, I think both of them you probably identify with as well, but I won't make that assumption. But the first is that I'm a military veteran, and this might seem like an interesting place to start, but it's one of those because again, I think it's important to recognize that a lot of people have identities that they choose whether or not they share those with you, right? So I have to make a decision or a choice often whether or not I'm going to let somebody know into my bubble of knowing that I'm a veteran. And the reason that I think it's an interesting one is because, again, lots of companies today, veterans, again, are not always quick to identify themselves as such because they've recognized that there may be some stigma and there's stereotypes and biases related to what your veteran, your service and what that service is all about. And you may have your own, again, through different experiences. I think a lot of us have a variety of things that have happened to us, especially as we think about more veterans today having experienced combat more recently, that there's a lot of things that we're still wrestling with and kind of making sense of in our world. And so I think, you know, we're afraid of people asking questions about it and concerned about, you know, being uncomfortable and answering some of those questions. And so I think, you know, that's one that I bring up because that's one by choice that I decide whether or not I'm going to let somebody in and to know. But for me, it's something I'm proud of. And I do share it because I do want more veterans to be able to talk about their service and their experiences. And I think that's helpful for our society. But the other one that I think maybe more aligned to what we want to talk about today is the fact that most of, you know, my identity are the majority identities. I'm a white straight man, heterosexual. You know, I fit all of those, middle-aged. I fit everyone. I feel like I fit every majority identity category almost out there. And to me, that wasn't something that I recognized until, I don't know how many years ago, but as part of my journey, you know, recognizing that it's important to recognize those as the privilege that comes with them and what I can do with them, as opposed to just thinking about how people are different from me or othered in a variety of different ways. And so for me, it helps me when I think about those to reinforce my obligation and why it's important that I recognize that when I'm in spaces where I am a majority, that again, I'm using that for good, and I'm not using it to silence anybody. I'm not using it to other anybody. And those are things that I think that we have to consciously think about. We have to be very deliberate and purposeful in thinking about that when we enter a space, and recognizing that people are probably trying, who are different from me, are probably trying to make me feel comfortable. And that, you know, again, I need to meet people at least halfway, if not more than halfway, when it comes to those. So anyway, that's a little bit about how I identify.
Well, I appreciate that. And yeah, I appreciate you not making any assumptions, but you're right that I do. I also identify as, those are both really kind of critical aspects for me. I think what's interesting, particularly about the ones that we choose, as you indicated, our veteran status, that with all identity, there's an evolution of how we relate to that identity. And that's been particularly salient for me as a veteran, as I've transitioned out of the military. So I served for just over 6 years. But then also as I've like had children and thought about how I talk about my military service with them. And it's just, there's a lot there to explore. So thank you. So today we're talking about classic deflections that we see that keep men from engaging in allyship work. And in our prep for this, you actually asked me, you know, kind of, how do I see deflections? How do I define it? And so I think I'll just kind of start answering this first question, and then kind of have your response to it. So when we think about deflections, we kind of use the thought of allyship and inclusion as a journey, with the ultimate destination being true equity. And, you know, there's a lot of off-ramps and distractions from that work, obviously. And I think what makes deflection unique is that it feels like there's a personal choice behind it that connects pretty directly to the personal accountability component of allyship. It, you know, it kind of communicates the, I'm not really comfortable. I'm not ready to talk about that, and I'm going to opt out. And I think to kind of connect to your perspective on privilege, is that it often communicates an element of privilege because you have a choice to not engage in conversation. Like you're saying, don't want to talk about that now, not ready to talk about it. And oftentimes there's no like follow-up commitment about when you might be ready to talk about it. So it feels like it's something we've just got to stop doing if we're going to make progress. So yeah, your thoughts.
Yeah. And I appreciate you clarifying, right? As we talk about what deflections are. And I think there's probably a lot of space in terms of thinking about this from a very behavioral action, you know, perspective on this. You know, some of the first research that, you know, my co-author Brad Johnson and I did for our first book, Athena Rising, which focused on mentoring and sponsoring and how men could be more deliberate and purposeful in engaging and doing inclusive mentoring and thinking about their network of mentees and the people that mentor them as well. But, you know, one of the things that we found, and again, our focus was on gender, but again, it goes across dimensions of diversity. But one of the things we found was that there were a host of reasons why, you know, and this is before Me Too. This is back in 2014, 2015. We were busy writing the book, and a host of reasons why men did not, and again, this gets to deflections, did not engage in doing mentoring or purposefully doing mentoring or sponsoring of women. And beyond the unconscious side of it, because I think that gets away from the deflection part of it, because you don't actually know you're doing it if it's an unconscious or implicit bias. But from the conscious side of it, you know, men told us that in some ways they just saw women as a risky risky investment, right? They weren't worth the time, in other words, because they didn't know how long they were going to be around. There was assumptions made that get to some of those implicit biases that were informing that around kind of their caregiving or motherhood status or potential motherhood status. But others were beyond that and really got into that comfort zone again, back to why they were not comfortable mentoring women. And some of the reasons, I think some people might be surprised, I don't know, but you know, one was around anxiety, that we, I think, sometimes have some anxiety around doing this work, whether it's mentoring, sponsoring, just broader ally, being an ally in the workplace. And the anxiety was around, you know, it's like, well, you know, I'm not really sure, what does it look like? What does it sound like? What should I be doing? What's appropriate in a workplace environment in these kinds of relationships? Because men told us that they had lots, you know, lots of experience, obviously being socialized and raised at home by important women in their lives, like their mother. Many of them had sisters, you know, and other important women in their lives. And today, maybe even they're partnered with women. And so they felt very comfortable that they were given a social script to follow, right? In terms of what was appropriate, what were within the norms of acceptable behavior. And so they understood that, but, you know, nobody ever gave them that script for what does that look like in the workplace? These are very, you know, these are colleagues. These are people who work for me and a mentee, you know, what does that relationship look like? And so a lot of the men said that that's one of the things that kept them on the sidelines. They just didn't feel comfortable in those situations. They had anxiety around it. And, you know, unfortunately, the solution to all that is increased interaction, more opportunities to do mentoring, more coffee, more interactions, more lunches, whatever, right? More time together more contact together is the solution to a lot of that. But other reasons were just concern about perceptions, right? So I'm not going to do this stuff because I'm concerned about what others may think of me. Mm-hmm. And that can go off in a whole slew of different kind of tangents of concerned about, well, if I start, you know, doing gender advocacy work in the workplace, well, what will people think of that? Or if I start having mentoring relationships or sponsoring relationships, what will people think of that? If I start being a very loud public advocate for women or women's policies, what will people think of that? And concern about either, you know, the WIMP penalty, right, of being associated with women in that way. And again, there's some interesting research in social psych on that, or just negative feedback, backlash, penalties. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to get penalized. I'm not going to get opportunities. I'm going to lose something by doing that. And again, you know, that feeds right into then the Me Too. You know, once Me Too went widespread in 2017, well, then that just added and exacerbated some of that around the ideas that there were these false narratives, right? That women are, you know, dangerous or scary, or they're going to make false accusations, all of which is untrue. There's no research to back any of that up. But we as men continue to perpetuate those kinds of narratives. And then I think, you know, there's this idea that if I advocate for equity in the workplace and in whatever way you're doing it, somehow I'm going to lose. Right. So, and this gets back to kind of our own privilege of recognizing that that's your privilege talking when you speak like that, this zero sum kind of thinking that, in other words, for women or any other minoritized group to advance means that I have to lose, I have to give up something, and which is absolutely not true. And the research shows us that as well. But again, these are widely held beliefs out there that, again, they're one form, I think, of deflections that we have to contend with and we have to recognize when we see them.
Thanks, Dave. A lot of great points in there. And kind of a common thread I heard is, you know, some fear. And one thing I think that you alluded to, didn't mention directly, maybe, as you're talking about, you know, mentorship and the importance of mentorship, is that so much mentorship that, you know, we tend to do in group happens in a really unformatted, unstructured kind of way. And the way that gender socialization works for us, we often are socialized to do a lot of that relationship building and informal mentorship in group. And so I think, in addition to kind of some of the, you know, the lack of structure for across gender mentoring relationships in the workplace, I imagine that there's also, I know I would have this fear of doubting my utility to someone whose experience was maybe so radically different than my own. And so I wonder, you know, I don't know, when you're talking about mentorship, I was like, oh, like I could see that also being a hesitation that a guy would have of saying, boy, like, you know, I see a ton of talented women in my organization. They seem to be doing really well, you know, without me. You know, can I really be of value and be of service to them? Because that's what mentorship is about ultimately. So I appreciate that. So the second question we had for you today was, you know, can you maybe talk a little bit about some classic deflection that you've come across and what you see being at the heart of them?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's just, I mean, so many of these different kind of examples that we see occurring in everyday settings. And I think this is the part that I think is that we really have to get to is why, you know, why might I choose? And again, I go back to the choice rhetoric here, that why would I choose not to engage in an allyship when I see either one, an opportunity. And so there's maybe people around me recognize the opportunity where here I could be an ally. Maybe they don't, but I think we feel a little more choice when it comes to that. And then there's when it's clear that I'm in a position where I should, or I could or should be doing something right from an ally perspective there in the situation. And the last part I think is really about when somebody confronts you about it is kind of the most egregious of those kind of three levels of it. And so the first one, I think it's really interesting that, and I feel like most people early in their ally journeys, and again, we're kind of talking about gender here, but it could be really in any other dimension of diversity. But early in our journey, we're developing awareness of how others may be experiencing things different from us. We have, I think there's a lack of confidence, right? In, am I really hearing that right? Am I really seeing, am I perceiving this in the same way that others are? And really doubting kind of our abilities in some case to be a good ally. And I think that's one of the challenges is developing, you know, a real good sense of awareness of what these are, what it means, what I'm perceiving, and then what I should do, right? So the first part, I think one of the things that holds a lot of us back from being a better ally or deflecting in this case is really that just being unsure or being unsure of our awareness of what's really going on there. And so I think that's one of the ones we have to really learn to get past and become more confident in seeing that. And the other part of that, I think that we heard over and over again from a lot of the research that we did in interviews with men about this, were their concern about also of making mistakes, of not being perfect, not getting it exactly right. Or is this the right thing to do? Am I going to step in and make a mistake here when I say this today? And that holds us back, right? That's another choice. That's an opportunity for us to have, whether you look at it from a fear or just, you know, concern about not getting it quite right or making a mistake, that holds us back from being better allies. And I think that the sooner we can learn to overcome some of that, I think the better we will get at it. But of course, you know, there's also that will lead eventually, hopefully, into the opportunity when we see something and we actually, okay, now I'm pretty confident that I perceive that, hey, today when I heard a guy say, he responded to another guy saying about, why don't we have more senior women here in our company? And the guy responded, he's like, well, that's because women don't want to work that hard. And it's, yeah, like, and I heard this and I was like, what? Really? You know, and I'm sure other people were, I'm assuming, felt the same way as I did. But, you know, now I have a choice. Sort of. I mean, depending on whether others saw me there, what I'm going to do, what I'm going to say, am I going to take action right there in the minute? And do I have the confidence? But what do I say? What do I say right there in the moment? And this is one of those ones that's really kind of, it's interesting because I think we go through this very quick calculus of who's in the room, who heard it. Do I know this person? Do I have a relationship with them? Is he some sort of, you know, serial misogynist, or I don't know, you know, who is this guy? And so we go through this calculus, I think, very quickly and trying to make a decision about what we're going to do there in the moment. And then the challenge is that a lot of times what the research shows is that a lot of times we won't do anything. And again, back to deflection and a choice, right? We can choose not to do anything right there in the moment, as opposed to just saying something, doing something in the moment makes a huge difference. And one, in creating your own confidence around doing this work, but it also others, if there's other people in the room or in the space, they will develop confidence in that, oh, you know, I felt the same way. And you know, I should speak up and I should do something next time. And so as we think about more of building a community, right, a culture of allyship amongst all of us, it's going to take more of a stepping out of our comfort zones, becoming maybe a little more uncomfortable and taking what we might feel is a little bit of risk and putting some skin in the game here, right? Especially I think as people with majority identities, we've got to be doing that. And hey, you're not going to get it right. And when I don't get it right, that's where, you know, I need feedback. I need feedback so I can learn and then I can get better. And next time I will do better at it next time.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And I, you know, and I, when you were talking about, you know, using that example, the thing I thought about around the calculus that we do in our heads was in Good Guys, you've got a lot of good graphics, but one is this, like the public and private framework that you use, mm-hmm. and some of the questions that we consider as we think about whether to engage or how to engage, whether to do it privately, publicly. And I, you know, I think that like when you hear a question like that, sometimes just saying, excuse me, like, and you may want to like practice the intonation of it, right? Because like certain intonations of, you know, but just like looking for clarification, right? Because oftentimes people will, you know, they'll say something like that. And then if something's like, I'm sorry, what did you just say? If you can pull it off in a way that doesn't feel come across as like accusatory, but really just like, hey, like I missed what you said. They can sometimes re-clarify and they can almost like catch themselves in that, you know, because a lot of people say something really stupid once, they're less likely to say the same stupid thing twice in a row. You know, I mean, they might, but they might be able to kind of self-correct. And that can be, for me, I think it's really, allyship is super behavioral. And I like thinking about passive ways that we can be allies where we help others do the work. I think that shifts the burden onto them in a way, like when they can come to like the realization we can anchor the learning in others if we can like help them be a little bit more self-aware. And so I think, you know, I like those like light lift methods, because I think, you know, because it's harder to schedule the time to have a conversation, to like go through all the, you know, to like do the play-by-play. How could it go? What do I say if he or they get upset? So yeah. And then the other thing that I thought about was, and we really have connected this really nicely to our third question about like, you know, how do allies engage when deflections occur? But I think my experience is that, you know, you see pretty immediate positive feedback when you make the choice to engage, even if you're unsure about the exact right thing to say. So like, if you can overcome that initial fear of, oh, I might not get this right, if you just can like say something, you know, like it's likely maybe there'll be somebody else in the room who can like kind of pick up or say, oh yeah, I actually didn't hear what you said either, or I wasn't sure what you meant either. And there's, yeah, when there's like a community around that, I think that can be really helpful as well. And then if you don't say something, I think all leaders have been in those situations where you saw something, you chose not to say anything, and a day, a week, a month down the road, you're like, ah, if only I had said something when that first came up, you know, I could have avoided this, what it's now snowballed into. So yeah. I appreciate that.
Yeah. There's some of those, it's really interesting, I think, from a kind of a group, you know, group dynamics perspective, meetings, you know, one of those places, I think meetings are a really, if you're on your allyship journey and you're trying to think about, hey, where can I get better? Anytime you're in a group, right, especially and we're often in meetings, just pay attention, just try to focus. I mean, we obviously, you have a job to do probably too, you have work to do in there, but pay attention to the group dynamics of what's going on. It's amazing to see all the thousand and one ways that you could be a, you know, they're little forms of allyship. And I really like your idea of kind of the, you know, what are the light touches? What are the, I think of them as small wins that I can create in doing this every day. And, you know, and you could just look at you know, when, how often are you seeing women in a meeting getting interrupted more than men? Are they getting the same opportunities to make their, you know, to make a contribution or put their ideas out there as men are? Are they being valued in the same way? And I know this is one of the ones that just kind of floored me when we were doing our interviews with women, that they'd have, I just heard numerous examples of this, of a woman have an idea, she put it out there to her team and nobody pay any attention to it. But, you know, 30 minutes later, some guy would say the same thing, repackaged that as his own. And it's like, wow, Julia, that's a great idea, man. Way to go.
Yeah. Knocked it out of the park.
Yeah. And I just said, okay, wait a minute now. I have never had that happen to me. And I'm pretty sure at that point, I had never seen it happen in a meeting. And I'm sure it did, because now that I'm aware of it, I can be watching for it. I'm looking for it. And when I see it happen, I'm like, oh, okay. Hey, I'm sorry, Julian, but how is that any different than what Mary just said? Right. Or finding a way to attach, you know, amplify her idea and make sure she's getting credit for it. Those are all ways, right, that we can take proactive, right, actions and not deflect in the moment. Because if you're aware of them, you can see them and you can choose what you're going to do right there. But, and again, interruptions are another one. And it doesn't always go the way you want it to. And I think this is one of those where, as to become better allies every day, as we're learning to be better, we try different tactics and techniques in doing this kind of thing. I had it once where I felt like a complete failure by the end, because I was in a meeting and one of my colleagues, she happened to be a woman of color, and she was senior to me, was making, she had a great idea, and I was like mesmerized. I was just listening to her about this idea she had, and this guy next to me, he got bored, or I don't know what, but he'd heard enough, and he just starts talking over her. And I just kind of, I was like, wait a minute, what's going on here? And I looked at him and I said, excuse me, but you know, she wasn't done, and I'm really kind of curious to hear what the rest of what she had to say. And he just got louder, and he started talking over me.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. And then it finally took the leader of the meeting to stop it and to say, you know, to redirect back over and to quiet this guy down. But it was, here I was, you know, I thought I was being fairly forceful in a meeting of people that, you know, I only knew a few of the people in the room. And I didn't know this guy. But it turned out it took a lot more in that case. Yeah. Right.
When behaviors that you expect to like crop up at like the dinner table with like little kids happen, like in a professional setting with a whole bunch of adults, you're like, hold on a second. Like, where are we right now? I really appreciate it. I liked, you know, you talk a lot about situational awareness, kind of early on in Good Guys. And that's a concept I think we're all aware of it, but it was something as a veteran, just as somebody in the Navy that I really heard a lot about, was just being like kind of constantly having your head on a swivel and being really attentive. I think, you know, and I, so one of the things I thought about too, when you're talking about that was, you know, in meetings. So yes, I think they're great places to practice and learn. And I think you can do some things. I think group norms, like meeting norms, like very clear guidelines about like, you know, just how do we meet together to remove, because it's to your point, like we do have jobs to do, and having to like pay attention to that stuff, like while really interesting, may mean that like there's other things that we're not paying attention to. Like maybe like we miss like the great idea that, you know, you identified, you know, your colleague had, because, you know, we're paying attention to the guy who's like interrupting and talking over her, you know? So I think even very like practical, you know, we at Great Heart, like we talk about, we do like a breath pause, like between speakers. We try to do that, enact that on our, during our team meeting, so that there's like a little bit of a, we slow the cadence of the meeting down a little bit, we make a little bit more space for someone who might be a little, you know, slower on the draw to like share an idea or speak into something. So, you know, just there's lots of like little examples of that, of just having like meeting norms, so that, you know, we can maintain the situational awareness, but also be fully present, and as, you know, as productive in meeting settings as possible. So we've got a couple more questions and we're running out of time with you, but in Good Guys, you made a super strong case that every male ally really needs to have an allyship elevator pitch ready to deploy at any given moment. I've got to ask, because I figure yours has gotten pretty good over the years. Would you be willing to share it with us in a minute or two?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, this is really important. This is your why, and it's important because it's your motivation to do the work. So it's important for us to, in committing and dedicating ourselves to doing this work, to keep ourselves focused, but also for others, right? How do we get in touch with that motivation for others? It's also really when someday you start being a great public ally, somebody's going to push back and go, hey, why are you suddenly so uptight about this?
Yeah.
So it's good to have that. And it's great for leaders because it's helpful in having your support, people who work for you, to kind of connect why this is important for them and why it's important for the business of what you do. So for me, it's a journey just like everything else. And it started for me, I think, when my wife, my partner, also a former, now retired naval officer. But early in our careers, we had very parallel careers. We would, we'd obviously share notes and ideas of what happened at work and this and that. And I'd hear her experiences and I would just be like shaking my head and was like, well, that's not right. That can't be right. And all these things that were happening to her that I'd be like, those never happened to me. And so there's a lot of the little gendered slights and microaggressions and sometimes outright discrimination. And then in other cases, it was more about kind of the career guidance and advocacy component where, for me, I didn't have to go look very far for that. And for her, it was like, digging around trying to find that information was really hard. And she just, it didn't come to her because, again, people didn't appreciate, certainly women, I think at the time in the military, and certainly it hasn't gotten a lot better today. But anyway, those early experiences really got in touch with my sense of fairness and justice. And then I started looking back into my own workplace, my own unit, and thinking about how were women experiencing these same things that my wife was telling me about. And I started making the connection and I was like, well, this isn't right either. And so how can I begin to create that change? The other one that later on that I think was really important kind of as a turning point for me was actually in my graduate work. And so this is much later on in my career. And I had an advisor, my dissertation advisor, and who's my mentor now, a woman, very senior and just, the top of her field. And we used to have a lot of these conversations, on the side about, the importance of doing this work and my role in it. And she felt comfortable enough at one point to say, Dave, you're part of the problem still. And I was like, what do you mean? She goes, well, when you say these things and you do some of these things, you're just reinforcing all of these kind of, gender biases and stereotypes and things. I'm like, what? Wait a minute. No, I'm one of the good guys. No, it can't be true. And I was almost indignant about it. And, the great thing about grad school is you get a chance to reflect quite a bit and think about these things. And after a while, I came back to her. I was like, you're right. I am. And I've got to get better. And this was really, again, kind of that eye-opening that, hey, we can all continue this journey and can grow. It's not a destination. I hadn't earned anything. And I certainly, hadn't reached it at any point there where I needed to kind of stop. And so for me, that was really important in kind of continuing this journey around my why and doing this work.
Thanks, Dave. Yeah, I appreciate the perspective and the personal story behind that. I think it's if you can't connect it to something personal, then it's going to never land as authentically or real as it will if you can. So, well, thanks for joining us today. Before we do let you go, can you tell listeners where they might find you if they wanted to find you online?
Yeah, absolutely. WorkplaceAllies.com is our website. It's all one word, WorkplaceAllies.com. And you can certainly see all the latest research and writing and places we're speaking and things we're doing. So I hope everybody will reach out and take a look.
Thanks, Dave. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode. Thanks to you, Dave, for joining us for an honest and great-hearted discussion. And thank you to our listeners for spending this time with us. We hope that you heard something of value and that it helps you to lead more inclusively. Do you know anyone that needs to hear this message? If so, be sure to use that share button. You can connect with me, Julian Geiser, and Great Heart Consulting on LinkedIn. As always, thanks for listening to Inclusion Catalyst.
You can bring your stories to the table as a partner and a host on the Inclusion Catalyst podcast. Visit inclusioncatalyst.com and click the link that says join us as a guest host.
And that's it for this episode of Inclusion Catalyst. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe and share with your friends and colleagues.